This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is where the conversation begins.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Two new or reused AFL coaches are on their way. Carlton and Essendon now considering their options, of course. What makes a good, modern, top-tier AFL coach these days? I'm Mary Guerin and I'll be joined soon on the Conversation Hour by Essendon great Kevin Sheedy. He can tell us firsthand. Maybe he'll tell us what he thinks of James Hird potentially re-entering the hangar. But you tell me, would that be a good move? And also, what does it take anyway to be an AFL coach in these cutthroat times? Also, do you answer the phone when it rings or do you stare at it in complete horror until it stops? And does that depend on how old you are? Tell me, are the young people in your life afraid of making or taking calls? And is that okay? Surveys have found that nearly 60% of Australians aged between 18 and 26 dread making or accepting a phone call. Is it time for oldies to get up to speed with when actually making a phone call is acceptable? Or is it the younger generation that's losing the art of conversation and genuine spontaneous connection, the skills that that involves? What's at stake there? I know I had to be dragged into the world of texts, for instance, but even now I feel it's more polite to send one in a lot of instances instead of just barreling on in and making that call. Have I lost something there? Or have I gained something? What do you do? Let me know what you think. Pick up the phone. Don't be afraid. Also this hour, we're going to be digging deeper on whether vulnerable kids are being drawn into the current crime wave or into criminal activity altogether. How can we stop that? And what are other countries doing about that? And later this hour, a shoemaker that first opened in 1854 in Melbourne to sell leather shoes to prospectors in the gold rush, it's finally shutting its doors. Why is it shutting its doors and how has it lasted this long? That is coming up in the Conversation Hour. But next, Kevin Sheedy, one of the very best people to ask what makes a great coach.
This is the Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So joining me now is AFL legend Kevin Sheedy. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
I'm great to be on your show.
What's that?
Great to be on your show.
Excellent, excellent. Listen, I do want to ask, it's a very long, big concept of a question, what makes a great AFL coach these days? You're one of the best people to ask. But I will address, you know, what's on everyone's minds for the past 24 hours. James Hird, should he be back in the hangar or not?
Well, I would think that he's got as great an opportunity as anyone else. He knows Essendon more than probably nearly any other person that's going to go for the job. Knows the background of the whole history of the club. And that's in the end how I went to get the job at Essendon, because I knew Essendon a lot more than most other people, even though I played at Richmond, because I bagged for them when I was a child. So I think James has got a very good understanding of the club and what makes it go, and I think a lot of people would support him if he did go back. But if he doesn't get the job, then so be it, then you move on, like every other club has had to over the years.
Are you campaigning for him behind the scenes? I saw some reporting that you were.
No, I just said I'd like to see James Hird get the job if he wants it and puts his hand up for it, which apparently he did last night. But I might be out campaigning.
Mm. What we've heard over the past 24 hours and even this morning, that there are many dyed-in-the-wool Essendon fans who don't want him back, who feel that, you know, the history with the supplement saga and so forth just rules him out. What do you say to them?
Well, I think that I think everybody deserves a second chance. That's how I see it. I mean, I remember when Carlton got rid of David Parker and they got him back in the end and said, we'd like to get you back. Well, we come back and won a premiership. Got him back up there and they haven't been any good since he left either.
So, I mean, you talk about the knowledge that James Hird brings to the club, and I think you've also talked about the love, that to be a really great AFL coach, you need to love a club. Is that right, or is it more about loving the game?
I think, look, I do. I think sometimes in certain situations, I mean, I would have thought that the last three premiership coaches of Essendon all loved Essendon. That's obviously myself, John Coleman and Dick Reynolds. And I'm pretty sure that Hird has that passion for the club. They want to make sure that he gets that next chance and doesn't let it slip.
You talk about that next chance, and it's probably a greater stakes for him. Do you think that, in fact, one of the better parts of it is that he'll really want to do an excellent job? You know, he won't want to muck this up.
No, of course. And he's hungry like a backyard dog, which is what I like the coach to be. If you can think of a better comment, sorry.
Junkyard dog, I don't think that's a cancelled term yet. We're talking about what makes a great coach. I've got one of the best of them, Kevin Sheedy, on the line. You're listening to him. Kevin, these days we've got Carlton and Essendon both looking. There's always this chat about whether or not you get someone new, breath of fresh air, or someone recycled, probably that's a pejorative term. What do you think is the difference between when you were a coach and now in terms of what you most need to bring to the game?
I think you need a great team around you, and I think that you need a great recruiting plan and setup outside your club, looking, sourcing all the best young talent. And very important, I had the best assistant coaches that I could reach out to at that time, and they all went on to become extremely successful. Mark Williams, Dennis Pagan, Neil Danaher, Mark Thompson, Mark Harvey. So I can't complain about going out and sourcing the right people, because they were not in a job when I got them, and they made me have some of the success that I had. So there are great people out there. Some aren't even being looked at, and the classic case is obviously Chris Fagan. He was assistant coach of Neil Danaher for 10 years at Melbourne, and no one really ever sourced him in the end, and he ended up a great coach at the moment.
Right. Do you think anyone's ever going to get, I mean, you must accept that no one's going to get the tenure that you got these days?
No, I got 27 years, and fortunate to get 27 years. So I often say only two people have done 27 years in the world, Nelson Mandela and myself. I'm just trying to make your listeners have a bit of a laugh, okay?
Absolutely. Kevin Sheedy, really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you very kindly. Lovely to be on your show.
Thank you, Kevin. That's, of course, Sheeds, the AFL legend. We're talking about what makes a great coach. And mostly this came to mind because Bob Murphy, our very own Bob Murphy, Bulldogs legend, of course, was talking this morning on Brekkie. He was talking about James Hird, but in these terms.
To be an AFL senior coach, it's like the difference between a session musician and Mick Jagger. It's such an unusual role that has so much attention, and the good ones, in my experience, were built a bit different. Oh. They're eccentric in some way, shape or form. And James Hird, I think, for all of the critics and for all of the, you know, the stuff that has come his way, when he was in the job, I think there was general acceptance that he was a front man. He was a proper senior coach.
So that's Bob Murphy talking about James Hird. Soon I'll be joined by Joel Bowden, Richmond legend, about talking about what he thinks makes a great coach as well. But Peter, you've called in from Albury. What do you think the Bombers should be doing? Hello, Peter. Sorry, my mistake. Hello, good morning. What do you think the Bombers should be doing?
Well, as a long-time Bombers supporter, I think we are looking for success as supporters, and we need to freshen up for sure in our coaching ranks. We seem to have a great talent list there over the last couple of years who have been struggling to perform. And is that the coach's fault? It's a tough one to say, but he takes responsibility for that. But I think there's some great senior coaches available out there.
Does James Hird deserve a second chance, like Kevin Sheedy says?
That's a real challenge, because we're emotionally built in as Bombers supporters to want Hurdy every time we can get him. He went through a challenging period with the Bombers. Can he do better this time around in different circumstances, possibly, but you would hate to see him not get success. That would be a big burden to carry.
Oh, so if he came in and then didn't get the success, it'd be even, wow, can you imagine that chapter in his biography?
not what he deserves. I was there when he played his first few games and watched him play his first few games, so to see his career in the last 10 years would love to have been more successful now. But that'll be his call and the Bombers' call, but we need a senior coach who can remove himself from the emotion, as Kevin mentioned, or Bob Murphy mentioned, that extra factor of being able to cope with all those personalities and the psychology of the modern game to deal with young men who are basically at work 7 days a week.
Indeed, and under the biggest pressure. Peter, thank you for calling in. So Peter's mentioned removing emotion from the game. Kevin Sheedy said it's about having a deep knowledge of the club as well. What does make a great AFL coach? Pam says, just love Kevin Sheedy, Bomber legend, statesman. Nelson Mandela would probably love Sheedy's comparison. Not sure about James returning, though. What do you think? I'm joined now, as I said, by Joel Bowden, a multi-Hall of Fame inductee, played 265 games with Richmond, and I believe, Joel, what is it, you had 5 coaches in 13 years?
Yeah, good morning, and unfortunately I did have a number of coaches, which doesn't really give me a great understanding of what makes a great coach, because unfortunately during my time at Richmond we didn't have great coaches. So you know, I think a connection with the players is hugely important. Being modern and relevant is also very, very important, but I think the ultimate is keeping it simple. And I've done a lot of junior coaching in the last 10 years. I live in the Northern Territory in Darwin. I coach girls' footy and women's footy a lot. You keep it simple. You make it basic. And then everyone understands what the coach wants. In individuals and in different types of coaching sessions, you can get the specifics. But you've got to have a game plan that's simple, that's effective. And I go back to Lee Matthews when he coached the Lions in their three-peat in the early 2000s. He kept it very, very simple. And he also said he wasn't a very good coach. He just had very good players. So you also need very good players and a little bit of luck in the draft.
And, Joel, when you talk about keeping it simple, I guess that goes to the message that you're sending out, not just to your team, but the reserves as well, because that was one of the criticisms of Brad Scott, wasn't it, that it just all got a bit lost within the club, that he might have been a great coach with great systems, but it just didn't go through the whole list.
Well, and it can also be exacerbated by the number of coaches that you got now. When I was playing, I finished 15 years ago, we had 4 or 5 assistant coaches. I'm not sure how many are there now, but the number of different voices that you hear, and listening to Kevin Sheedy is a breath of fresh air, where he talks about coaching for 27 years. I think the reason why they had such success is he was the constant, and then they had some fresh voices coming in. You know, Matthew Lloyd and James Hird, champions of the Essendon Football Club that they are, only ever had one coach. So longevity is also hugely important. But as Sheedy said just recently on the radio with you, Mary, that he mixed it up and he had Mark Harvey come in. I know he had Gary O'Donnell, Neil Danaher, and they were all budding coaches who then spent time with the great mentor Sheedy, and then they moved on. So maybe you need to have a great mentor, and the system that the AFL are putting together nowadays is where they're putting senior coaches with experience, someone like John Longmire, Simpson, Hinkley, who are available at the moment, and then putting them next to a younger player who's just come out of the system and now going into coaching.
So Joel Bowden, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you the obvious question. Do you think that James Hird can and should come back?
Look, I think he can, and it'll depend on what Essendon want. There's no doubt that there is already a groundswell of support from Essendon supporters, and just heard your most recent talkback caller then saying they would love to see Hurdy back at the Bombers, and there's that emotional connection. It's whether or not the board will make an emotional decision or a very analytical decision. Football clubs are now $50 to $100 million businesses. They make decisions based on business, membership drive, sponsorship drive. All those factors will come into play. Clearly, James Hird has the skills to coach, and he did it previously. You know, he coached Essendon and was reasonably successful. And then it comes down to what success looks like. You know, the word success is going to mean different things to different clubs and different boards and different supporters. I know when I was playing the football club at Richmond, premiership and the supporters wanted success, but that wasn't necessarily a premiership. That was being competitive every week and knowing that when they went to the footy, if they drove from Mildura to go and watch their beloved Tigers play, that their team was going to put in 100% effort and be competitive with a chance to win. So success looks very different in different clubs, and I think for the Essendon Football Club, their board, and Andrew Welsh as their president, they're going to have to define that before they choose their next coach.
Joel Bowden, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Joel Bowden, former Richmond player, played 265 games, so he knows what he's talking about. This is on text. Yes, give James Heard a chance. Everyone deserves a second chance in life, often turn out to be the better for it. But also this on text, you might want to play nice with James Heard, but the real victims never received the slack that he got, and James Heard was coached during the most disgraceful time in Essendon's history. A lot of conflicted opinion there. It'll be interesting to see what comes into play for that Essendon board and the selection committee. And this from Susan, how about giving some people a first chance when you start giving people second chances? What do you think? And I'm going to ask you to call me for the next session, the next conversation. We're talking about whether or not you still answer the phone when it rings. It might actually be a generational phone war that we are facing. Gen Xers apparently and boomers still think a phone is for calling. Gen Zs apparently think, and millennials think, it's an unexpected call is a home invasion. Which is better? Is it protecting your attention span, or is it getting on that phone and having a chat?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So, do you answer the phone when it rings, or do you just wait until it stops? Are the younger generations losing the art of conversation? Let me know. And my eye was drawn to this subject because there was a piece in The Age by my next guest. To give you an idea of what she thinks, the headline was, "I don't make phone calls even in an emergency. Why you should never ring someone under 40. Zoya Patel is with me now. Thank you so much for joining me, Zoya.
Thanks for having me.
I loved your piece. And just to give listeners a sense of your conviction about this, if they haven't caught up with it, let me just read the first lines. "There is nothing worse you could do to me than call my mobile. When my phone rings, I feel irritation mingled with fear." Zoya, can you explain why this is the case for you and apparently your generation?
Well, I should start by saying that I did grow up without a mobile phone until I was about 16, so I'm definitely an older millennial. I remember the days of calling people on the phone. I used to have all of my friends' house numbers memorized. But these days, I really feel like the moment for the spontaneous phone call just to chat is over. And if someone is calling me, I almost always expect it to be either a spam call or bad news.
Yeah, okay. So that's interesting that you grew up without that, and yet you, so you might have had that as a bit of a, you know, a hurdle to you accepting those skills. But I can tell you that my kids who did grow up with mobile phones, they still don't like it as well. Tell me about the young people in your life. Do they stay away from making a phone call? And what do you feel that this is doing for them? Elsie says, maybe it's not a generational thing. I developed a phone aversion in my early 20s. It was about 40 years ago. Zoya, do you fear that you are losing a skill, that your generation is losing a skill with that, or is it protection, self-protection?
I mean, I definitely don't think we're losing the skill or the ability to talk to people. And I think, you know, one point I make in my article is that I would still prioritize talking to people in person over any other form of communication. Like, I think it's really important to have face-to-face conversations. You know, I work in an office, but we have primarily working from home days, and coming into the office is a really important part of,
Hello? Phone problems?
I'm so sorry. One second.
Okay. Zoya Patel, maybe having phone problems. That's what we're talking about today. 1300 222 774. Yes. What happened?
And so I got a phone call.
And of course you didn't answer.
Of course I didn't answer. And this is probably the first phone call I've made with you right now in a long time on purpose. I do think that we're able to talk to people, but I do think that calling people feels less intentional and less efficient than texting or even emailing. And I find that my friends and I are really good at staying in touch over group messages and even voice memos, but I don't think I've talked to one of them on the phone in literally decades.
in literally decades. So you just hear their voices when you get in real life, as it were.
Yeah, genuinely, or over voice notes. I write about in my article a friend of mine who lives in Scotland, and our friendship really became cemented when we started sending each other long voice notes. But both of us agree that we could not stand talking to each other on the phone. It just feels completely unnatural. And it's almost as though having the space to craft a message and think about what we're saying and then reply to each other in that way gives us a chance to have deeper conversations than we probably would if we were talking on the phone.
That's so interesting. Let me know what your experience is, 1300 222 774. Is it a generational thing or not? This on text, I'm 69 and I loved it when email and text arrived because phone calls are my least preferred form of communication. In a call, you can't read the body language, can't think about what to say before replying and can't edit what you say. So they're the pros and cons of texting. Let me know what you think. Yeah, if you have to text. So I was so interested also in your article when you said that even in an emergency, you haven't called. Tell me about that one instance where it was kind of important for you to get in touch with someone and you didn't call them.
Well, I used the example of when I went into labour with my son 6 weeks early and we were down at the beach. It was literally Christmas Eve. So I think I went into labour at about 1 a.m. on Christmas Day and, you know, we rushed and packed all of our things and we left the house and we not only did we not wake anyone up to let them know because we were at the family beach house, but we then texted everyone to tell them what was happening. And I actually thought that this was a much better way of managing the situation because inevitably our family was going to panic. I didn't have the bandwidth to deal with people on the phone panicking and worrying about me. So being able to message them and say, you know, the headline is everything's fine, but this is happening, gave me a chance to kind of manage the message, but also just put a buffer between me and their reactions while I was trying to deal with, you know, the physical discomfort of a sudden emergency relating to having my son, which was very stressful as it was. I don't think I called anyone, even while I was in hospital with him for several weeks. We managed everything over text and my partner kind of ran interference. And I think that that was actually an effective way of dealing with it.
That's really interesting because you're protecting yourself, you're managing that communication at such an important time. If you're just joining us now, Zoya Patel is a writer who penned a piece on why you should never call anyone under 40. We're asking about your comfort or discomfort with making phone calls out of the blue. Zoya, there is that text that we saw that, as say, well, in texts at least you can manage your speaking, you can manage the tone, but don't we lose something by avoiding those conversations as well? We lose the tone that might be conveyed through a voice. We miss the warmth potentially or the ability to clarify someone in the moment.
Well, this is why I would advocate for the voice memo.
I can't do the voice memo. It's too tricky.
You have to just give it a go. I swear I had a bigger version to it and then I just kind of leaned in and now I'm all about it. And what I love about the voice memo is that it's the perfect in-between spot of a phone call and a text because you get to have the tone, you get to kind of demonstrate what you're thinking through your voice, but you also get the time to prepare and say what you want to say without having to kind of manage the other person's immediate reaction.
Do you write it down first?
No, I feel like I'm pretty comfortable just talking ad lib, but I imagine some people maybe would. I think that there is a setting for the voice memo, like I wouldn't send the voice memo in a professional setting. And I do think that in a workplace, phone calls are sometimes just a necessary evil. And, you know, we all have to deal with meetings that we think could have been an email. I think that's somewhat inevitable. But I think the voice memo in personal relationships is actually a really useful tool.
Jared, you've called in from Maryborough. What do you think?
I can remember back in the 60s and 70s when, especially 56, when Mum would go to the telephone, would be sitting on a bench somewhere and it would ring and you have to answer it because you didn't know who it was. It just answered the phone.
And it didn't stop either, I think, back in the day.
Because you didn't know what was it. Could have been a problem. And then they'd have catch-ups over the phone with the cousins and things like that. So I'll ring at the same time next week or something like that. Around about 1980, things changed a bit because you could see the telephone number on your handpiece. Mm. And about 1990, when phones actually 1990 or something like that, when phones came in, and I disagree with your presenter. I'm 70 years old, and she's talking gobbledygook to me.
What?
I don't understand that. And I think people have become very precious and don't want to get on with, you know, being just talking to people and getting out there.
You think it's most important for that. Jared, thank you for that. Paul in Frankston, what do you think? Do you agree?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm another one who's older generation, but just naturally prefer text. And I still talk to people on the phone. I was laughing with your producer saying, "What, you want to put me on air?" I'm talking, saying that I like texting.
But we sometimes you have to push yourself for the sake of radio, Paul. Thank you. I appreciate you doing it. But why were you a convert to text then?
Yeah, I think I prefer writing anyway. It's a slower process. You actually read out my text before as well.
Ah, right.
So it was all those things about I'm a bit more visual and auditory. You can think about what you're going to say. You can edit it before you send it. All those sorts of things. There are a lot of advantages, I think, in that respect. And I remember one time in my early days that when I was at work, and my boss had to say, "Come on, just make the call." And I was just bringing somebody to get a supply of batteries or something for some project we were working on, but I couldn't make myself make the call even in a work situation.
Okay, so it's not about generations then in your view, Paul?
I don't think so. I think you can see that the next generations are perhaps more so than I was. Like, I'll do it, but I'm noticing, again, even in my family, there are some who just won't. So I do find it interesting.
Yeah, Paul, thank you so much for being on the line with us, even if you're not comfortable about that. We are talking about whether there's a difference in generations. I think it's been a bit muddied, Zoya. I feel like people are telling us, well, it's an internal thing. It might not just be a generational thing.
I don't necessarily think it's a generational thing. I think there's definitely, you know, higher proportions of people who are just comfortable with texting in the younger generations, for sure. But I think Paul actually hit the nail on the head when he said that, you know, some people are just better at visualizing what they want to say and being able to kind of craft that message. And I'm sure I'm not the only person who, when I'm dealing with conflicts and I want to send someone an angry text, I'll draft it and then I'll just sit with it for a while. And inevitably I'll come back to it and go, maybe that wasn't the best thing to send. Whereas in conversations, you know, in haste, you might say things that you regret. And I think that that's one of the advantages of text. I do also think, though, that
it's an old principle puts a new technology.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the more comfortable you are with technology, obviously, the more comfortable you are with texting. I always joke that my mum, who probably also hates talking on the phone, but just isn't super comfortable with texting because I don't know that she's as good at texting. Mm. And so often her response to literally anything, whether it's good or bad, is just okay.
Well, sometimes that says a lot.
And, yeah, and often I'm left thinking, are you angry at me? Are you happy with me? But that, you know,
there you go. You've got to get her on the line, Zoya.
Super comfy texting.
Maybe
I don't think she'd particularly want that either. So I think sometimes there is a bit of a lost generation, perhaps, of people who don't particularly feel comfortable with either.
The vagaries of human communication, which will always ebb and flow with all of these different things. Zoya, thank you so much for joining us today and kicking off this very interesting conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Zoya Patel, who penned the piece in The Age. Bex from Burwood, you've called in. What do you think?
Yes, we send voice memos. I'm 50 and my friends and I send voice memos all the time, but we have rules.
Okay.
You can't listen back to your message because you might start censoring yourself.
Uh-huh.
You listen to them at a minute and a half, like speed. And keep them to about 3 minutes. So you can actually, like, you reply
to each other.
Sometimes. Sometimes you try and not ramble on, but you can always tell when you're rambling, which is the reason why you don't delete them, because you lose the context of your message a lot of the time.
Oh, so the understanding is that you don't ever lose them because you might want to listen back? Is that the deal? I don't understand voice texts.
Sorry, you don't listen back to your messages.
Oh, you don't? Oh, no, that's right.
Because then you start getting self-conscious and you think, oh, I'm just rambling, which you quite often are.
But giving permission to your friend to have you on at double speed.
Your friends know what you like. You don't send them to, again, like it's not a professional setting. It's, you know.
Indeed.
Generally rambling.
Bex, maybe you will get me then going into the world of voice texts. My daughter will probably be appalled at me joining her in that, but thank you. I should maybe look into it. This on text, yes, I'm 28 and working in media relations. My boss always wants me to pick up the phone and call the journalist. She's a bit old school, but I'd rather text and email first. The call is the last resort, unless it's very urgent. This on text as well, to hear another human voice is to know that you're alive. That's from V. Oscar, who's 25, is generally hesitant to answer the phone, absolutely hates to book anything via phone. Well, yes, we have so many different options to us that we can get around that. I'd love to continue that conversation, whether by phone or by text. It is 1300 222 774. If you ever do want to call me on the Conversation Hour, it is 24 minutes to 12. Soon, this hour, we are going to be talking about the end of an era in Melbourne, a shoemaker that opened to sell shoes to prospectors in the gold rush is finally shutting its doors. That's a little later. But next, we're going to dig a bit deeper on whether vulnerable kids are being drawn into the current crime wave and how can we stop that.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, it's been reported that a judge in a children's court was examining the case of a 16-year-old in front of him on firebombing charges, and the comment from this judge was that he was the third or fourth intellectually disabled child that he'd seen being targeted by criminal gangs. This child was said in court to have the cognitive function of a child aged between 6 and 8, someone between prep and grade 3. So that's an issue. And obviously, without going to the innocence or guilt of any of the children involved in any of these cases, we wanted to see, are kids with learning problems or other disabilities being targeted by criminals? And if so, what can be done? Susan Badawi is Associate Professor and Co-Director of the Criminal Justice Research Consortium in the Social Work Department in Monash University. Thank you for joining us, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
What that judge is quoted to say, does it surprise you?
Sadly, not at all. Pretty consistent with this exploitation of what is known internationally as child criminal exploitation. Children with neurodisabilities of all sorts are more vulnerable to being groomed and exploited by criminal gangs and other adults for the purposes of committing offences. So it's actually quite consistent with research we conducted in Victoria about 6 years ago. And it's also consistent with what's seen internationally with the very limited research in this space that's come from places like the UK and Ireland.
Do we know exactly how widespread this is here?
Unfortunately, no. We have no consistent definition of the issue of child criminal exploitation anywhere in Australia, and we certainly don't have any available monitoring of this phenomenon either in Victoria or elsewhere in Australia currently. So it's difficult to say how widespread it is, if it's increasing or decreasing. Certainly, the phenomenon of adults exploiting children for their own gain is nothing new. It's been around for centuries, literally. However, what seems to be different, particularly if you speak to professionals that work in relevant areas, is the ease with which adults are able to target children and young people, particularly through things like social media and encrypted apps.
Mm. You're listening to Susan Badawi, who is from Monash University. We're talking about the exploitation of children. And Susan, this idea of, and this problem of the exploitation of kids with learning problems or disabilities, what's the prevalence, or what is expected to be the prevalence here, and what is happening overseas?
We absolutely can't speak to the prevalence here. The only data we have is really from this one study we conducted 6 years ago, as I said. And in that case, we found about half the kids we identified that were criminally exploited had some kind of disability. So really a vulnerable group, but so are other groups who are more marginalised, who are excluded from school, who are excluded from their family homes and living in residential care settings, for example. So it's more a marker of vulnerability, you know, primarily by virtue of the ease by which young people can be exploited that have disabilities. And we see the same thing around sexual exploitation of young people with disabilities. So there's a real comparison that can be made there. but where we recognise kind of sexual exploitation as a crime and a form of child abuse, we're still a long way from being able to really clearly recognise child criminal exploitation as similarly a form of child abuse.
And you've looked at what is happening overseas and their different approaches. With that knowledge, what do you think that Australia should be doing to be better in this space?
I think the very first thing we need to do is be having these conversations and changing the narrative, understanding that this is a form of child abuse and exploitation, and with that needs to follow some clear definitions and monitoring of the issue in each jurisdiction and potentially nationally. There needs to be investment in education, both of young people, parents and professionals in this space, and then work towards identifying and evaluating mechanisms of responding to it. Things like multi-agency panels and so forth. So I'm aware of some work that is starting to happen in this space. In Victoria, the violence reduction units have commissioned an NGO called Think Village to co-design a community-led campaign in this space to prevent and reduce grooming and child criminal exploitation. So I'm going to be working with them over the next 12 months to design and evaluate that campaign. I'm also aware of some education that's gone on for police in other jurisdictions in this space and children's courts that have requested education in this space.
Well, obviously that you are working with the Victorian authorities there, but this is also the state, among others, that have adult time for adult crime laws coming in. And with that frame that you have of, you know, this sort of activity being child abuse, are you worried by those sorts of laws that might catch, in particular, the exploitation of any kids, vulnerable kids, whether they have disabilities or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Courts and processes have been notoriously poor at distinguishing between what's abuse here and what's youth offending. In the UK, for example, there are mechanisms to treat these behaviours as a form of child abuse, and there's mechanisms to move those children towards a protective mechanism rather than a punitive mechanism. We don't really have anything similar here as yet, so certainly concerned about the idea that we can punish our way out of this, particularly when we're looking at adults exploiting children with IQs as low as 40.
Yeah. Susan Badawi, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Susan Badawi is from Monash University. We also thought that we would touch base with Dan Stubbs, Victoria's public advocate, the first public advocate we've had with disability. And Dan, you don't work with young people, but you have views about how we can support them in the justice system. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
What do you think could and should be done in a circumstance where kids with learning problems or other disabilities in particular are exploited, potentially exploited in this way?
Mary, as you said, I'm Victoria's public advocate and my role is to promote the rights of people with disability, and I'm not specifically the advocate for children and young people, but we do see the results of the situation where young people with disabilities haven't got the community-based supports they need through various programs that we run. And the supports we're talking about are really to make sure that the protective factors for children are maintained. Now, that can be by some of the state government programs, perhaps child protection, but also it could be disability services, to make sure that these children and young people are kept maybe, you know, probably connected and with their family or in school and engaged in their local community, really. Because obviously these children and young people are incredibly vulnerable to this sort of exploitation if they're not deeply connected with their community and family.
And it has to start young.
Yeah, that's right. And we already see, for example, last year, the Youth Parole Board reported that around 30% of kids in youth justice have an intellectual disability. Too many people in our criminal justice system have intellectual disability and mental illness and similar disabilities, cognitive impairments, I'll say. And we have to drive that down. So we need to get in before this, and we need to make sure that all people with disabilities, particularly children, are supported at every point, including right at the beginning when they first have contact with police. We need to make sure there's an independent third person with them to support them in that interview. I don't know if these kids had that. I don't know the specific details, but often young people, often police aren't calling in the independent third person to make sure that that best practice is happening.
Is that something that who would look into that, Dan?
We're certainly advocating to police that there needs to be every single police station needs to make sure that they're calling on that independent third person to ensure that those police interviews are handled appropriately, and that's it's for police to have the training and identify the needs of any person with intellectual disability who they're interviewing.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mary. A pleasure.
Dan Stubbs is Victoria's public advocate, talking about kids with learning or problems or disabilities being exploited by criminal gangs. Also this hour, we were talking about our relationship with our phones and our texts. Is it a generational divide? Someone is saying, what about the youngish, lonely person? They need someone to talk to. The phone is essential for that person, even if it is frustrating for the receiver. This on text, people with ADHD like me tend to be oversharers. Texting has saved me many times being able to edit and delay the response. I'm often ruminating with anguish for days after chatting on the phone or face-to-face, just saying too much to entertain and not thinking through consequences. This is well from Lou and Q. I love texting. I'm not a chatty person. Since texting came in, I'm more in touch with my friends as I don't have to phone. Just pop a short how are you message. Thank you for all of the texts and all of the calls as well about this. This is well on text, though. We're all becoming very afraid of relationships. It's so troubling. Coming up next, do you know about a shoemaker called Maloney's? Maybe you have been their customer. You've had 172 years to be their customer. It opened in King Street 172 years ago and is now going to, after many, many iterations, shut its doors. We're going to be talking to the owner about why and how next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
We will be talking to the owner of Maloney's, shutting after 172 years. But first, Daniela, you've called in from St Kilda. What's your verdict, phone or text?
Oh, I'm mid-50s and I'll still pick up the phone and have a chat to people, to my friends, but I've got children who are teenagers and I couldn't pick up the phone to them unless it was to tell them that I was dead or something. So I only text them.
Do you mean you've tried calling them and they just let it go to voicemail?
They will never. Doesn't matter. I can call 15 times and they went, then I'll send them a text and they'll respond in a nanosecond.
That's so good. And yet I've also have children who text me multiple times. If I don't actually text them back, they'll be mum, 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 mum.
Yeah, and all in one word, like mum. Next sentence. Can you? Next one. Send me. Next one. The code for next thing. Netflix. Drives me insane.
Daniela, I think you should just leave them a voice note. That's our new thing now.
Oh yeah, I was interested to listen about that. I don't know about those. I'll have to upgrade my IT skills.
Same, Daniela. Thank you so much for calling in, for giving us a call out of the blue. I still love it. Anytime on the Conversation Hour, please give me a call. Well, Maloney's, as I said, opened in King Street 172 years ago and is now going to shut its doors. Doug McDougall is one of the shop owners and joins me now. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, good morning, Mary. How are you?
I'm very, very well. 172 years. It first opened selling shoes to prospectors heading to the gold rush. How do you stay in business for 172 years?
Well, you have to adapt. So it started in 1854 with James Maloney. So James made shoes for the prospectors plus anybody else, and it's kept going. Really, That part of making shoes went for three generations. There was George Thomas Maloney and then Edward James, E.J. Maloney. And then after that, they started adapting. They were making shoes as well as then they made ice skates. The family moved into, they were very good figure skaters. So my father-in-law, Jeff Henke, he was an ice skater, and his wife, Gwyneth Henke, Gwyneth Maloney, and her sister, Patricia. So they were into ice skating. Then Jeff developed it into a bit more ski industry.
Started selling ski boots. You really did embody the adapt or die motto.
Yes, it is. And I think that's the secret. Then we moved from there into really Jeff expanded it into the ski industry and expanded from the shoes to they helped develop ski lifts at Falls Creek and then ski hires at Mount Buller and Mount Hotham, Dinner Plain Development.
And you've clearly done something right to be that. But so why close?
Well, I'm into my early 70s now and my wife is catching up quickly. We love the ski industry, but we just, I think it's time to retire while we can and just spend some more time skiing and family. We've got a grandson and we'd just like to travel some more.
The kids didn't want to take it over?
No, look, they've got their own careers. They've both got very good careers. One is married, moving to Queensland, and the other one is very established in Melbourne. But no, they have got their own careers, and we're very happy with that. But I think it's just time. We don't have any real reason. I know a lot of people, it's cost of living and all the other costs. They are factors, but... look, I think if you love something, my wife's the stylist, and she buys all the different orders, the clothes and things. We've got a beautiful shop in South Yarra,
That's what it's ended on after 172 years. This wonderful shop. So I need to ask: is there going to be a going out of sale, going out of business sale?
There is. We have been thinking of retiring the last 3 or 4 years, but we just keep putting it off and off. But no, we've decided to make a date. So we have a sale on now. All our goods are half price until we sell out. So we've sold a great portion of it, but there's still some bargains. It's all beautiful European, North American ski wear, shoes, you know, beautiful shoes made in Italy. It is very nice.
It is very nice. I'll let you have that ad on the ABC, considering you're going out of business there, Doug. But tell me, what are you and Joe going to be doing in your retirement?
Look, in our retirement, we will. We hope to travel a lot more to go skiing and catch up with friends. And we've got tons to do. So we're very happy. We feel very privileged having a great life in the, we spent a lot of time in the mountains. And
did you have any angst, Doug, about making this decision? What was it like?
We did, because it's a big decision to shut. It's been in the same family since 1854, and we felt a responsibility to keep going. But but we decided in the end, look, let's enjoy our life. We've got great friends in the ski industry. The ski industry is still growing despite all what people may think.
Year round now.
Yes, year round it is. Mm. And look, with all with people travelling overseas now in December, January into the Northern Hemisphere, it's busier than ever. So we're lucky with that. We're lucky with snowmaking and having great resorts in Australia and plenty of snowmaking.
And you now are going to go out and enjoy it.
We are, yes. And no, so it's we don't have any negatives as far as that goes. We just have, we really have positives. It's tough around the world everywhere, but I tell you what, the ski industry has been great to us, and we feel very privileged and very privileged to be part of a family that's been in the
part of a family
in the same business. Yes, that's been going for
172 years, and you've been part of Melbourne in all that time. Doug, thank you so much for talking to us today.
No, thank you, Mary. You're very kind.
Doug McDougall, Maloney's. After 172 years, Catherine in Northcote says, in 1970, my parents bought me a pair of leather lace-up ski boots from Maloney's. I wish I'd kept them. This on text, we've been talking about phones versus texts. I'm deaf. I use hearing aids that link my phone via Bluetooth. I find at times phone conversations are challenging. I love text, email and lines. And this from RJ in Druin. I love phone calls, as sometimes I'm lonely. However, the caller to me probably regrets because I love talking. Ha ha. Thank you for talking to me on the Conversation Hour. It's been another cracker of a program. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.